La dose de rappel, un moyen de nous protéger plus longtemps. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Pledge resistance!
What's up? This is Saul Williams chilling here in Montreal, here on CKUT. Peace.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Genderfeel, a podcast where we hopefully get a little bit closer to understanding what the hell gender is. I'm your host and resident gender detective, Tuck Woodstock. Hey everyone, hope you're all hanging in there. This week on the show, I'm excited to share my chat with Evyon Whitney. Evyon is a sex educator, a sensualist, and a sexuality doula. And in this episode, we're going to talk about what those terms mean and how they are relevant to Evyon and me and all of y'all out there. For example, what does it look like to try to be present in your body if you have chronic pain or like gender dysphoria? And what does it look like to be a sensualist and a sex educator when you're also asexual?
I now see it as a superpower, and I'm really proud to be ace.
But first, just a heads up in case you missed it last week. This is our last episode of this season of Gender Reveal. If you are new to the show, you're just finding it in a little season break, welcome. We've got all sorts of great episodes in our back catalog for you, including this season's earlier chats with people like Chase Drangio, Deshaun Harrison, and Kay Egbebi. And then earlier conversations and other seasons with people like Tori Peters, Catching Tom, Maury Turner, Travell Anderson, Carmen Ray Machado. I could go on and on and on and on, but instead I will point you to genderpodcast.com/starterpacks, where we have listed a bunch of our favorite episodes sorted by interest. So you can look at like just the interviews about parenting, or just the guests who are Indigenous, or just the authors whose books you've read, or whatever. That's genderpodcast.com/starterpacks. And speaking of website URLs, here's another one for you. Patreon.com/gender. That's where you can send us as little as $1. And in return, you'll be signed up for our weekly newsletter, where we will be posting behind-the-scenes updates on next season throughout the entire break. Plus, you'll be actively helping Jules and I stay employed and helping fund our grant program. And now, it's time for This Week in Gender. I have been sitting here for way too long, staring at the screen, trying to decide whether to write a This Week in Gender segment for y'all. This is our news segment, and the problem with the news is that it continues to be mostly bad for trans people. I will say this instead. I watched Framing Agnes last week, back when it was streaming on the Sundance website. If you haven't heard of it, Framing Agnes is a documentary about trans people. I don't know how to explain it better, but you can Google it. I'm also not sure when it will be available to stream again, but whenever that happens, I really encourage you to see it. It's great for many reasons, but something that struck me while I was watching it is not only does the film give us a tiny peek into the lives that a handful of specific trans people were living in the 1950s and 60s, but many of the actors and talking heads we're seeing in this film are also trans people who have been in trans community for many years, if not decades. So in that way, it reminds the audience that, oh yeah, not only were there people transitioning 60 or 70 years ago who could theoretically maybe still be alive today somewhere, but there are these people who are our peers today who transitioned in like the 90s and early aughts. They're definitely still around and we can be learning from them. And I say this now not because I just invented the concept of trans elders in this moment, but because we as trans people, and I extremely am not immune to this, we as trans people love to act as if we are just now for the first time inventing transsexuality or gender nonconformity or whatever. And then I talk to my friends who transitioned 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, and I'm like, oh, right, we've been doing this forever. And in some ways, it's quite different, but in many ways, it's very much the same. I think all the time about my friend who is like 15 years older than me, and I think even older than that in trans years. And he was talking about how when he first transitioned, he got in a fight with Buck Angel on the internet. And then I was like, oh yeah, I also got in a fight with Buck Angel on the internet. And it's just like a rite of passage. I don't know how many years apart that at some point when you transition, you have to get in a fight with Buck Angel on the internet. Anyway, all that is to say is that this isn't new. People of all different ages and backgrounds have gone through this and come out the other side. So if you feel like you are all alone in the trans salt mines, I think it's worth taking another look around and trying to figure out who else is down here with you and maybe even who else knows a way out. Not out of being trans, just out of the metaphorical salt mines. This looking around can look like reading books, watching documentaries, listening to podcasts, not just this one, but there are like multiple podcasts specifically focused on trans elders. It can also look like just going on the internet or maybe into the real world and like making friends and having human relationships. And of course, maybe you already have trans peers and elders and have read Susan Stryker and Black on Both Sides and have both laughed in pleasure and you're like, Tuck, stop explaining baby trans things to me. I know all of this. I am so old. And to that, I'm like, yes, I know. I'm sorry. I just feel moderately responsible for all of the transes whose eggs cracked by listening to this podcast. And also, if we keep having the same intra-community discourse every 3 weeks, I'm going to lose what is left of my smooth little brain. This has been This Week in Gender. We've got two Thaymail messages for you today. The first one is from Jay, and it says, I am raising money for my top surgery so I can start to feel at home in my body and be authentically me. Even just a little bit helps. Please donate at gofund.me/39980A71. Thank you and appreciate you all. End quote. I just made a donation. I'm going to put a link in the show notes so that you can also easily donate. I do feel bad because you have to pay at least a little bit of money for Thaymail, and I want Jay to make that money back. So if you could donate, that would be great. And while you're doing that, I will read you this second Thaymail message, which is from our friends at Nico Blank Works. And it says, the Dimlit Tarot is a weird and queer tarot deck steeped in the aesthetic, and it's crowdfunding again, now with pictures of actual copies. If you are in the market for a deck with a uniquely queer take on tarot, or just want to see how spot gloss on black looks, check it out at ulule.com/the-dimlit-tarot. Evian Whitney is a sexuality doula, sex educator, and sensualist. Their work focuses on decolonizing, unshaming, and liberating sexuality at the intersection of identity, pleasure, and embodiment. Evian is the author of Sensual Self, a self-guided journal that will help you reclaim your unique sensuality. She also hosts a podcast of the same name. The way we always start the show is by asking, in terms of gender, how do you describe yourself?
I describe myself as a non-binary person.
And what pronouns would you like people to use for you?
I like they and she. And I want to say that the reason why I put they before she is because I really want for folks to prioritize using the pronoun they for me, because she feels like you know, that favorite sweater that you have that you've worn for like 12 years. It's got holes in it. It's so warm and cozy and comfortable. And it's great. But also they feels like a really snazzy pair of shoes that you never wear because you're like, I want to wear these with the right moment or the right outfit. So I'm trying to make they as worn out as she.
So you have a podcast as well. And in December 2020, you made an episode that was about coming out as non-binary. And you said, I want 2021 to be the year that I'm fully expressed. So how did that go?
Man, 2021 was a good year for me in the realm of like non-binariness and identity. You know, it was a really big leap for me to make that big shift from my podcast, which was called The Sexually Liberated Woman, to now being called Sensual Self. And, you know, I was a little concerned, but it's been so well received. People have given me so much like positivity, and I've gotten a lot of community actually, because a lot of the people that follow my work are also non-binary and trans. Yeah, 2021 was a good year. I just felt really warm and welcomed and really excited to like feel out the space of being unapologetically in my non-binariness.
I love that. You came out, as we said, December 2020-ish, which was in quarantine, which makes you in the quarantrans class cohort.
Oh, yay. Do we have buttons?
Someone should make them if they haven't already.
Please.
But yeah, I'm curious if you feel like pandemic or quarantine played any sort of role in this. Yeah, you're nodding. Tell me more.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I mean, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot is, even though the pandemic has been horrendous, I've been really grateful for the time that it has given me to really examine who I really am. And I remember these moments where I would be in my apartment. This was actually in 2020 when the pandemic was starting. I felt like I got so much clarity about my gender identity because all I had at the time was my body and myself. And I was really focusing in 2020 on gender euphoria, because for me, my experience of being trans or being outside of the gender binary has been like, oh, you got to feel dysphoric in your body. Like, you have to hate your body. And there are moments where I feel dysphoria, but a lot of the times I'm feeling really good in my body. So 2020 had me really exploring, like, what are the things that make me feel good in my body? What are the things that make me feel good in my gender? I think that's why I kind of came up with this feeling of the pronouns they being like a nice pair of shoes that you fucking love, that you spent lots of money on, but you never get to wear. Like, I feel like the pandemic has allowed me to get really clear on the things that feel good for me in my body, both like sexually, sensually, and also when it comes to my gender, which has been really nice and also like hard at the same time.
Yeah, it can't be too easy. But you're already talking a lot about what we want to talk about today, right? Which is sensuality, sexuality, being in your body. On a more recent episode of your podcast, which was called Decolonize Your Gender, you said that the depth of knowledge you have about your sensuality wouldn't exist without the depth of knowledge you have about your gender. And I want to talk about that. But I think first, we should just make sure we're on the same page. Can you talk about what you mean when you talk about sensuality, since that's really the crux of the work you do?
Yeah. So I want to say that first, a lot of people think that sensuality is synonymous with sexuality, or that to be sensual means that you are being sexual. That's not necessarily wrong, but I want to create a little bit more expansion of that word and have us explore our sensual selves outside of the confines of sexuality, especially for those who, you know, sex isn't at the center of their world. I identify as asexual. And so for me, my sensuality is not necessarily an extension of my sexuality. The way that I define sensuality is that it is the process of being fully in your body and in your senses. For me, when I grew up, when I heard the word sensual, it was designated toward a certain image or mannerism that someone had as a performance, so that the folks gazing upon it would feel a sense of inspiration or desire. And again, I think that sensuality can have a performative effect if that's what you're going for. But the flip for me has been seeing my sensuality as not something that's meant to be consumed or gazed upon, like not something that I'm doing for other people's pleasure, but for my own. I see sensuality as a really personal experience, something that's really private, and oftentimes something that people wouldn't even be able to tell that I'm doing or engaging in, because it is so subtle. And it is this process of me paying attention with my senses and also working to stay in union with myself in the midst of a world that is telling me and constantly trying to dissociate me out of my body. So sensuality really is about paying attention with the senses. It's about having a really deep connection with your body, and not just your physical body, but your emotional body, your pleasure body, as I like to call it. What happens in that space? What sort of sensations come up in the body? What thoughts come up in your mind? What emotions flood through your experience as you are in that process of connection with yourself?
Yeah, so I generally feel like I'm pretty good at being in my body, as far as I'm good at reading hunger cues and energy cues and knowing when I need to stretch. And like, I grew up as a dancer, and so, you know, I feel like grounded in that way. But when I hear words that are at the core of what you do, like sensuality, but also like pleasure, birthright, desire, maybe this is a function of being raised by two Capricorns, but my brain like doesn't know how to make a personal connection to those concepts. Hmm. So I guess I'm curious, if you're working with someone who's like, I really just on a core level cannot understand what it means to like connect to those concepts or embody those concepts, what do you think are like the first steps to getting more familiar and comfortable with that kind of language with yourself?
I think about like, okay, let's take out the word pleasure. What are some things that you can do to make your body feel good? Because that's what pleasure is. It's about making yourself feel good. So what are things that make you feel good? And when it comes to desire, like, we can totally take that word out of the picture and focus on like, what are you hungry for? What are you craving? You know, like, what are the things that like you sort of feel like a full body yes that you want to just like go in the direction to?
Yeah. So you have said you've been exploring the phenomenon of the sensuality of being trans. That's a quote, but I am curious how you approach embodiment work and sensuality work differently for trans people and other people who might have specific reasons for not wanting to be present in their body because it causes them either physical or emotional pain.
Yeah, for me, my sensuality, as I said before, is so interwoven with my gender, because my gender is so interwoven with my body. And then, you know, my body is interwoven with my sensuality. Like, it's one beautiful circle. So I can't think about my sensuality or my sensual self without considering my body or my gender. And so I've been thinking about like the ways that my body can be sort of like an oracle for me that shows me where to go, or shows me what is missing, or shows me what I need, and how like my ability to connect to my body, even when it's hard to connect to, because that's another thing that I want to say, is that like, I don't feel that sensuality is all like chocolate covered strawberries and bubble baths and things like that. You know, like, I think that sensuality is a practice that is also about honoring what's hard about our bodies, because the truth is that it can be really difficult to connect to our bodies. It can be really difficult to be with ourselves and our emotions. When it comes to working with clients who are trans or non-binary, or even just like Black folks, you know, like, there's so many reasons why we shouldn't be in our bodies, that we shouldn't be prioritizing the things that make us feel good. We're living in a world that is constantly dissociating us from not just our physical selves, but our, you know, spiritual selves, our emotional selves. And so, yes, there is going to be fuckery in the world. Yes, there is going to be all of these forces and systems of oppression that are trying to take you out of your body. But can you feel into this moment one part of yourself that you feel good about connecting to? Even if it is just like your pinky finger. This is something that I talk about with clients who are disabled, who have chronic pain, where they're like, it is really difficult for me to be in my body because my body is in pain all the time. And one of the things that I say is that, like, you know, we're not experiencing one thing at one time. Like, we are also experiencing like a multitude of emotions, feelings, sensations, information. And so, is it possible for you to feel like, yes, I feel pain, but also I can feel a sense of delight, as I look through my window and I'm looking at the sky, and that makes me feel happy. Or like, yes, my back is killing me, but also I love the feeling and the sensation of my feet being on the ground and feeling that sort of support there. Or yes, my fucking boss is getting on my goddamn nerves, but like I am eating something really delicious that is making me feel really good. You know, like, is it possible for us to hold the pleasure potential and the potentiality of like connection with ourselves in the face of discomfort and fear and dissociation? And I think starting small is a really great way to try to access that.
I have had a much harder time during pandemic being in my body than ever before, because so many of the ways that I normally am present within myself are not available to me. And also so many of the ways that I'm engaging with other people and with the world are all virtual. I feel like I'm dissociating more because I'm like, what's the point of being present in this house that I've been in for 2 years?
Yeah.
I said something to my girlfriend about how I'd been dissociating, and she's like, oh no. And I'm like, I don't feel like it's been bad. I just am like, I don't need to be here. Mm-hmm. But on another level, I do feel like it is bad and I should be here.
Yeah. I want to say first that like, I think it's okay to dissociate sometimes. Like, I think that sometimes, like I was saying before, being in our body can be hard. Being present to the world can be challenging. I feel like it's okay for us to have moments where we disconnect, because it might be easier for us than trying to force ourselves to connect to ourselves when we don't want to. So I just want that to be said. I'm thinking for someone like you, who's like, the way that I connect to my body is by being around other people and like actually moving my body in public spaces. Maybe it doesn't have to be like an hour-long climbing session. Maybe it's just like 5 minutes where you're checking in with your body and your breath. And again, that's hard to do. You know, one of the simplest but also the most difficult assignments that I give clients who are like wanting to connect to their bodies is like, lay flat on your back or sit on the ground or sit on a chair and just like close your eyes and breathe and just like feel what it feels like to have breath in your body. Feel what it feels like to have a body. Notice the sensations of your body being held up by the chair or the floor, or your back being supported by the ground or whatever. And just notice what's coming up. Also, after you do this practice, whether it's like for 3 minutes where you're just breathing and paying attention and noticing what's coming up in your body, take out a journal or a notebook and just like jot down what came up for you, like thoughts, images, bodily sensations, and just like track your progress.
Yeah. A journal, a notebook, the book Sensual Self by Evian Whitney. Any of these things are good.
Oh, yeah. My book. My book as well. That's a great resource too.
It is. That's all sorts of great prompts. It's funny, when you were talking, I was thinking about the most intentionally grounding thing I do in my house is when I'm feeling really, really out of it, I'll go just like shove my whole face in my cat and like feel those sensations. And
yes,
one of those sensations is I'm allergic to her, but it's worth it because of all the other sensations that come up.
Yes. It's interesting to watch animals too, because like they are the epitome of being sensual to me, because they're just so in the moment. And they're just moving based on their urges and their instincts and what they want and what they love and what they don't like. So, yeah, I feel like our little animal friends, they can really help us and mirror for us, you know, the ways of being present and connecting to ourselves and just like really listening to what we want at any given moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to talk about the other facets of your work as well. You are a sexuality doula. I would love to hear more about what that looks like. I'm curious about who you work with sort of demographically and what the most common issues are that people are seeking help and guidance with in that work.
Yeah, as a sexuality doula, you know, essentially, I think a lot of folks are familiar with doulas in the birth realm or the death realm. And one of the things that I notice about doulas is that they really work with people through some period of transition, whether that's life to death or pregnancy to birth. And so the way that I work as a sexuality doula is I help people release any sort of shame or confusion or fear around who they are as sexual beings, who they are when it comes to their body, their sensual selves, their gender even. And I hold them by the hand. I guide them. I give them tools and resources to help them come into the full expression of their authentic sexual and sensual selves, whatever that looks like. The things that people come to me for, like not just in the sexual realm, is like folks are so hungry for different versions of what a sexual person looks like. I think we've all been fed this particular archetype or image of a liberated sexuality. And when I came out as asexual, that's when a lot of people started flooding to me being like, holy shit, I'm ace too. I had no idea. And I'm so happy that there is someone out there that can model the different ways that sexuality can look. I think a lot of people hear my work and they think, oh, you're just helping people have amazing orgasms and giving people sex education, which is a part of what I do. But the other part is like, I want to meet people where they're at and ask them like, who do you want to be as a sexual being? Who do you want to be as a sensual being if it wasn't attached to the shoulds that our culture is giving us about what that needs to look like?
Yeah. You mentioned that you're ace. And I was reading this article you were interviewed in for The Atlantic, written by Angela Chen, who also wrote the book Ace.
Yes.
And Angela wrote that early in you sort of coming into your asexuality, you questioned whether being asexual was compatible with being a sex educator.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally understand that feeling. But then I also feel sometimes like being ace spectrum is almost like a superpower of that, because we are sometimes coming to sex from like a different, maybe more like observational anthropological lens, I feel, which I think can lead to a lot of really rich and interesting conversations about sex and sexuality. So I'm just wondering what that journey was like for you from coming into that and being like, is this compatible with my work, to like where you are now, where you're empowering other people to come out as ace as well?
Yeah, it's taken me a long time to get here. I'll be very honest and say that, you know, I've been a sex educator for almost 11 years, and I've only just started to understand what it means to be on the ace spectrum. I didn't realize that asexuality was on a spectrum until I read Angela Chen's book. And that's what really opened so many doors for me about my own understanding of my sexuality, because I was taught that if you're asexual, it just means that you don't have sex, you hate having sex, you're basically sex repulsed. And there are definitely ace folks out there who are like that, and that is valid. And, you know, sex isn't everything, and that's okay. But there are a lot of folks who fall on the ace spectrum where it's like, yeah, sex is cool. It's not my center or my focus of my mind. Like, there are other things that I would rather do. I think the reason why I had this sort of conflict of like, can I be an asexual sex educator, was because of that misinformation that I got, that like, well, how can you be a sex educator if you're asexual because you don't like sex or you hate having sex, which I think is possible. I think there are a lot of amazing, incredible ace sex educators out there who might be sex repulsed, and, you know, they can offer up a different perspective because of that. I think also, it's just, this is coming to my mind too, I think it just speaks to the hypersexualization that we have as a culture. Like, in order for me to be a reputable sex educator, I need to be having lots of sex. I need to be having multiple partners. I remember actually when I came out as ace last year, I got so many comments, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments from people that were like, wow, thank you so much. I think that I'm ace too. I am getting Angela Chen's book. And then, you know, there were a handful of comments that were like, this makes no sense. How can you be a sex educator when you're asexual? And I think that's the thing that is frustrating and I sort of get afraid of, is that there's still so much misinformation about aceness. Like, people still think that asexuality is like this black or white, very binary understanding of what it is. And so, yeah, I wasn't planning on making my asexuality a big part of my work, because I don't really want to like box myself in. But what I'm finding is that my perspective, because I'm ace, around sex has like created even more experiences and different ways for me to think about and connect to sexuality. And I think that I can offer that to other people too, who maybe they don't identify as ace, but they just want different ways to explore pleasure and sensuality and intimacy with their partners. So I now see it as a superpower, and I'm really proud to be ace. I'm happy to talk about it anytime. And there's a lot more out there than that little statistic says. I think the statistic that I came up into this work thinking was like, only 1% of the population is asexual. I'm like, bitch, please. There's no way. Because if we think about asexuality as being on a spectrum, there's so many of us that fall in multiple places on that line, sometimes depending on the day.
Yeah. Just a fun fact for listeners, which is that frequent guest of the show, Mackenzie Griffler, is interviewed in that book, Ace.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because she's a star. But yeah, I resonate a lot with what you're saying. I was thinking about how I also remember talking to a family member of mine who was describing her experience in life. And I was like, oh, that's asexuality. Like, you're just an ace person. And she's, I think, in her 50s. And she was like, no, that would mean I'm having sex with myself. And I'm like, no, but okay. I'll just let you figure this out.
Yeah, I feel that. I mean, one of the reasons why I think it took me so long to come to terms with my own ace identity is because of that misinformation. And also, it takes a lot of labor to teach other people. And sometimes it's just hard to do, you know? So I understand why folks maybe might not want to talk about it or come out about it. I guess for me, I didn't really realize how much of a big deal it was until I came out. Like, I thought people would just be like, oh, okay, cool. So anyway, but I mean, it just created a lot of conversation, which I'm happy about. I think it's really good.
Yeah. Something else that I also have thought about a lot, and actually I think we talked about it a little bit sort of tangentially on a recent episode with Kay Agbabi, is how queerness is so explicitly tied to who you're having sex with.
Yes.
That I think there are special pressures for queer people to be having sex in order to prove their sexuality. So it can be challenging for like ace spectrum queer people to feel queer enough. But I'm saying that as a queer person, and maybe that's not true, and I'm just guessing. So I guess I'm curious, like, as you, someone who actually has experience in talking to queer and straight people about this, do you feel like queer ace people have a sort of a different relationship in any way than straight folks to sort of the pressures of having to like prove your sexuality?
Oh my God. I think about this so much. Especially because like I'm in an open relationship, and it was the whole point of us opening our relationship was for me to have these sexual experiences with other people. And what I was finding while I was dating people and they, you know, just wanted to fuck me, I was like, I don't really want that. Like, that'd be cool. But what I really want is to like take a bath with you and have you braid my hair. Like, that's like, that to me is what sex feels like. Like, that's what I want. And when I was realizing that there are a lot of people who, I guess, like, to be queer means to have lots of like sex, I was like, wow, damn, am I queer then? Because like, I don't, that's cool, but that's not like my first choice. I wouldn't pick that. So yeah, I think about that a lot. I think about how limited our language can be. And the thing that I've been trying to do for myself is like expand the definition of sex and to see it not as like something that results in an orgasm and involves genitalia, but like what is going to make my pleasure body light up and make me feel good, or what's going to feel like emotional intimacy, what's going to make me feel like me and my partner are really connected on a soul level. And we don't have to always have sex to do that.
Privacy for me and my personal life is really important to me, despite making a show where I talk to everyone every week. And it feels like it would be perhaps even more challenging for you as someone who is explicitly talking about sex and relationships and who posts about your relationships and like your relationship to sexuality. I'm just curious if that affects your relationships or your relationship with yourself or your idea of your own sexuality or sensuality, about the fact that it also is your job to share that with the world.
Yeah, that's a great question. When it comes to my relationship with my partner, we have really, really good boundaries. And I make sure that anything that I'm talking about when it comes to our sex life, it's like I'm making sure to protect him and get his consent. I also want to say too that, like, I think a lot of folks will, like, you know, listen to my podcast or look on my Instagram and see the things that I share. And I just want to say, like, that is like 1/16 of what actually goes on. You know, like, I think sometimes we think that, like, oh, they're sharing their entire relationship, but y'all have no idea what my relationship looks like or what kind of sex we're having, how many times we're having sex. So I just want to make that really clear that I share what I want to share, and you know about me what I want you to know about me. I just don't want people to get it twisted that, like, I'm divulging in so much information. Like, people barely know anything about my relationship, which is great. But they do know a lot about, like, my sexuality and, like, my sex life and my gender, because I'm very public about that. Like, I'm very public about the things that I'm feeling into, the ways that I'm growing, the ways that I'm learning. I do it very publicly. And I think something that I've been trying to feel out, especially this year in 2022, is, like, what does it look like for me to hold some of that processing back a little bit? Because I've always been a public processor. And it's, I don't see anything wrong with that. If I could toot my own horn, I think I'm very good at it. I think I'm really good at creating community while I am in this process of growth, because I think it helps other people grow as well and think about themselves. But I'm really curious to see, like, what would happen if I keep some things hidden to myself and to prioritize this private relationship that I have with my sexuality, my process, the relationship I have with my body and my gender, and also just, you know, not putting things on the internet all that much, you know, like just keeping some things sacred. And that's been a challenge for me. It's been an area of growth because, like I said, I'm so used to going on the internet and talking all kinds of stuff. But I feel like that's just another piece of, you know, what the pandemic has given me, which is, like, all you really have at the end of the day is yourself. So what sort of relationship are you building with yourself?
I hate it when strangers ask me, like, what I do for a living, because I'm like, oh, I make a podcast, or, like, I'm a teacher. And then they're like, oh, what do you make a podcast about? I'm like, no, please don't ask me. They're like, what's your podcast called? And I'm like, no. What do you do when people ask you what you do? Do you just tell them?
Most of the interactions I've had, funnily enough, have been, like, people recognizing me at, like, the farmer's market or the grocery store. So they already kind of know who I am. But if I'm, like, you know, at the grocery store and the cashier is checking me out and is like, hey, you know, what do? I just tell people that I'm an educator. Mm-hmm. Like, I used to, back in the day when I was, like, very radical about my politics with sexuality, I'd be like, I'm a sex educator. And of course, that would make people clutch their pearls, like, she said the word sex. And then I would be like, yes, that's right, I'm a sex educator. But these days I'm just like, I'm an educator. I remember one time I was in New York a couple of years ago, and I was taking an Uber, and as it usually happens in an Uber, you know, they're like, oh, what are you here for? You know, you got came from the airport. Where are you from? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, I'm here for work. And he's like, oh, what do you do? And I was just, I couldn't be bothered. I did not want to have a conversation with this person, but I particularly didn't want to have a conversation about the work that I did. So I said that I was an educator, and he was like, oh, do you educate children? And I just said, yes. I was just like, yeah, I do. And he was like, thank you so much for your work. And I just felt like that compliment was kind of misplaced, because he was thinking that I was, you know, teaching the little ones in school. But yeah, I am very selective about what I tell people as well, because oftentimes I just don't want to get into it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you were just talking about how your approach to talking about your work has changed, but I imagine you've been doing this work for so long that your approach to the work has changed. And I was listening to an episode of your podcast, I think it's the Decolonize Your Gender one, where you were saying something like, oh, I have this episode 5, and it has some really problematic ideas about gender, but I was thinking about taking it down, but I haven't taken it down, but I don't like it anymore. And, like, I relate to that as someone who over and over again on this show is like, why are you listening to early episodes of my podcast? Please stop doing it. And everyone's like, haha, I love to be a completionist. And I'm like, ah, yeah, I guess I'm just curious how your approach has changed, and also how you reckon with this experience that so many of us have, where these things that we no longer really believe are, like, still artifacts on the internet that people are still accessing today.
Oh, Oh my gosh, Tuck, you're asking such incredible questions. Like, you're getting to the pit of my brain. I think about this shit all the time. And yeah, like almost every episode that I come out with my podcast now, I'm like, so by the way, I know that I said this back in like 2015, but like, you know, this, my feelings have changed. And like, I'm still sort of grappling with that because I want for there to be a record of my growth. Like, I think that that is really healthy. I think this vision that we have of people just like changing overnight is really like, that's not how it goes, you know? And I'm okay with there being accountability in the ways that I have grown and the things that I have said that were problematic that I have now changed my narratives or my beliefs around. But also like I'm thinking about a couple of episodes on my podcast, like the one about, episode 5 about masculine, feminine polarity. I'm like, I don't want anyone to stumble across that podcast and think that that's who I am now. Because I think a lot of people think that. Like, they'll think, oh, podcast episode I listened to where Evian was talking about masculine and femininity in 2015, that's exactly how they feel about it today, which is not the case. So I'm trying to grapple with, like, how do I hold myself accountable to the ways that I have changed and the ways that I have grown? And how do I also protect other people and even protect the work that I do? Because I don't want people to get it twisted about, like, I'm trying to find a way to sort of bridge that gap. And the thing that I've been thinking about doing is like going into those past episodes and like just recording a little clip at the beginning being like, hey, this is Evian from the future. My feelings have changed about this. You can listen to podcast episode 67, which will give you more of an idea of whatever, just as a way to like direct people into like, okay, this is who I was before and this is who I am now. But I wonder also if other people feel this too, like people who maybe don't have podcasts or aren't public facing, you know, people, like if they also feel weighed down by how much they've changed, because we now have like archives of like who we were 5 years ago and the things that we were saying and the tweets that we tweeted. It's like, I think that's why I come back to this place of like, I need to hold some of this stuff back for myself, because there's some beauty of living in public. And then there's also like this rub, I think, that we're talking about right now of how complicated and misleading that could be, you know?
Yes. So we've done like a dozen advice episodes on this show, and we have a 30-page and counting Google Doc of just questions that people have submitted that we haven't gotten to yet. So I was scrolling just to see what questions that were around sexuality and sexual orientation people have asked us. And I think that the two most common questions that we're getting is either, my partner is scared that they'll stop being attracted to me if I transition, or I'm scared that they'll stop being attracted to me if I transition. Is it worth transitioning if it's going to make my partner perhaps less attracted to me? And we just get that all of the time. Mm. So I'm just curious if that's a thing you ever run into, or if you have any thoughts for that general concept. Obviously, every situation is different and we don't necessarily have the details on any of them, but just sort of broadly that tension where people feel like by being their self, they are jeopardizing this sort of romantic or sexual happiness that they have. Happiness, quotes.
Oh, yeah. That is so fucking tough. And for me as a sexuality doula, like, I have like a million questions I would want to ask these people about, like, what is the state of your relationship and how long have y'all been together and is there transparency already and honesty? Like, are y'all, what kind of conversations are y'all have? Like, these are things that would help me to better answer this question. But if I were to just give a general answer to just this general question, I would say choose yourself. I know how difficult that is because we live in a world that is constantly telling us we need to couple up and we need to get married and we need to have kids or whatever it is. And there's a high price that is put on our ability to be in a romantic relationship with someone else or multiple people. On the other hand, I want for that same energy to be directed to the relationship that you have with yourself. You know, like one of the things that I say all the time in my work is, the most important sexual relationship you will ever have is the one that you have with yourself. And I think a lot of us are not putting as much emphasis, importance, exploration onto that relationship, because we are being told constantly, like, no, it's about the sex that you have with your partner. It's about trying to, like, rock their world in the bedroom. Like, but what about rocking your own world? You know, like, what sort of desires do you have? And then coming back to, like, this piece of around identity, I mean, the question that I would ask back is, like, are you comfortable not being the truth of who you are as a way to stay in this relationship? I know for me, the idea of me not being the truth of who I am in any capacity, whether that's in a romantic relationship or relationship with me and my mom or relationship with my friends, literally makes my skin crawl. Like, I cannot be in a relationship with anybody if I cannot be the full expression of who I am. So, like, for me, it's not even a question. It's like, if I want to transition, if I want to be the person that I know that I am, and I feel so strongly in my bones that, like, this is the way that I want to express myself and be myself, I say, fuck it. You're like, I'm going to do it, you know? And I know that that's difficult. And I know that maybe other folks would give advice about, like, here, this is how to, like, walk your partner by the hand and educate them about, like, what it means to be trans or non-binary. And here are the questions, like, you can do that. And also, I hope that you will stay in union with yourself, because the relationship that you have with yourself is so important. You're all you've got at the end of the day, you know? And I would encourage folks to, come hell or high water, stay in union with themselves and to do what they really want and how they feel, you know?
That's such a great answer. And I really hope that people listen to it and that it is helpful to them. I do think that the answer is, if not always, then 99.9% of the time, do what is best for your long-term happiness, which I think is being yourself, not making compromises for what you think another person might need. Because sometimes it's not even true.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we do all of this fretting and then it's actually fine.
Yeah. Oh my God. When I was thinking about coming out to my partner as non-binary, I was fucking scared shitless. I was so afraid. I was afraid that it was going to be the end of our relationship. And I was ready. I was really ready to be like, okay, but if you don't want to be with me because I'm non-binary and that is too difficult for your brain to wrap itself around, that's okay. I'm going to have to be okay with that, because I will not shrink myself in order to make you feel more comfortable. And it was perfect. My partner was just like, cool. It was like not a big deal. So it's very possible that, like, you tell your partner that, like, I am trans, or I want to transition, or these are the different ways that I want to adorn or express myself. And they'll be like, sweet, I want to do the same. Like, that'll give me permission to also play around with my identity. So yeah, I think we can catastrophize a lot. I know I can, as someone who has general anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't always have to be so horrible.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the part of the show where we ask if there's anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't talked about yet.
I just want to mention my book. I really do, as a really great resource. You know, we've been talking so much about sensuality today and connecting with your body. And I wrote my book, Sensual Self, which is a guided journal, actually. It's not something that you're meant to just, like, read and, like, put on a bookshelf. It's something that you're supposed to interact with. And there's lots of questions and exercises for you to do that gets you to understanding who you are as a sexual person, who you are as a sensual person, the things that make you feel good, and also, like, what is going on in the landscape of your body in some really interesting ways. Like, it's, I know that body talk and thinking about being in your body can be really difficult, but I made it so that these prompts are really approachable and fun and lighthearted, and I'm really proud of it. So if folks are interested in learning more about how to get into their sensuality and connect to their body more, I definitely recommend that as a resource.
The way we always end the show is by asking, in your ideal world, what would the future of gender look like?
You know, I knew that you were going to ask me this question, so I've been thinking about it, the Virgo that I am. My answer to that is gender would be everything and it would be nothing. Yeah.
That's going to do it for this season of Gender Reveal. If you had a good time or learned something from this episode, please share it with a friend. And if you haven't yet, I would love it if you subscribed, maybe left us a little review, maybe scroll back through the archives to see what other episodes you might enjoy. Evian's book/self-guided journal is called Sensual Self. It's available in all the book places. Their podcast is also called Sexual Self. It's available in the podcast places. You can also find Evian at evianwhitney.com and on Instagram at evian.whitney. We are, of course, on Twitter and Instagram at genderreveal and at genderpodcast.com, where we have transcripts of every episode, starter packs for new listeners, and a contact form in case you need to yell at me about something. If you want to support the next season of the show existing, please consider joining us at patreon.com/gender, which will also automatically sign you up for our weekly newsletter and other fun perks. If you are looking for trans community, we've got our own very wholesome listener hangout internet space at bit.ly/gender/2. And if you have a question about gender that you'd like us to tackle on a future episode of the show, there is a link in the show notes for you to submit those questions anonymously as well. And one more thing, you may not know that my other job is also teaching people about trans stuff, but in a completely different context. So if you're looking for a trans consultant or a workshop facilitator for your company, organization, creative project, please feel free to reach out at sylveon.co. That's sylveon.co. This week's episode was produced by Julia Linus Goodman and by me, Tech Woodstock. Our logo is by Ira M. Lai. Our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Additional music this week by Blue Dot Sessions. Hang in there, and we'll be back as soon as we can with more feelings about gender. My producer caught that on your website, you have a fun facts section where you write, I'm non-binary left-handed and I never eat the first bite of the apple. Please tell us how this apple works. What happens? You just ask someone else to take a bite of it? You only take someone else's apple?
I have literally never been asked this question before. So well done. Thank you for being the first. So I take the first bite of the apple, but I don't eat it. I don't know. I've always done this ever since I was like 3 years old. I felt like taking the first bite of an apple is like popping open a bottle. It's just sort of like you take the cork off and then you just throw the other part of it. So that's what I did. It's like I'm breaking the seal of the apple and I throw it away. But when I finally got with my partner, I actually give him the bite because he's like, you shouldn't waste food. And I'm like, but it's, you don't eat the first bite of an apple. Like, that's weird. So he eats it now.
Wow. That's so funny. Thank you so much for explaining this. We were both like, what's going on?
Thank you for asking.
We should really end it there because how can you beat that?
Listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
To make an appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19, visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence plan for your area and book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose. And keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
wanna fail.
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K for
kitten.
Camp.
See, wait. Fianrufsig. U. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
Avec Nathalie Dipalma sur les ondes de Sécurité 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir et merci d'être à l'écoute. Il y a 16 ans, le 23 novembre 2006, une loi a été adoptée à l'Assemblée nationale pour que le mois de février devienne le mois de l'histoire des Noirs au Québec, afin de souligner la part de ces communautés à la société québécoise. Et nous, on tenait à souligner le travail exceptionnel des membres de la communauté noire LGBTQ+. Nous avons donc invité l'artiste-peintre Kezna Daz et Massimadi Montréal, qui organise sa 14e édition du Festival des films et des arts LGBTQIA+ Afro, qui se tiendra du 11 février au 11 mars 2022. Nous commençons tout de suite avec Soyane Diallo, responsable du développement à la Fondation ainsi qu'au Festival Massimadi. Bonsoir Soyane et merci beaucoup d'avoir accepté l'invitation.
Bonsoir, merci de nous avoir invité.
Pour débuter, j'aimerais que tu nous parle de ton rôle et de l'évolution de ton implication au sein de Massimadi.
Oui, donc moi, j'ai été en fait bénévole pendant 3 ans au Festival Massimadi avant de travailler ici. Donc l'année où je suis arrivée au Canada, en fait, j'ai commencé à être bénévole pour le festival. Donc la première année, j'étais bénévole.